When someone asks Asif Manvi where he's from, the answer is complicated. A baby born in Bombay, a boy raised in northern England, a teenager transplanted to Florida, and now a man living in New York City. In No Land's Man, his first collection of personal essays, he reveals the many and often contradictory layers of identity that make up who he has become today. A correspondent on Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and again, author of the brand new book, No Land's Man, published by Chronicle. It's a great pleasure to welcome Asif Manvi to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being here. Very nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to write some essays, write some things down about your life, about who you are, and how you came to this place?
I've always been writing. I've been writing since I was a little kid, so I was writing for the stage. I wrote a one-man show many years ago. The idea of writing a book never occurred to me until I was asked, actually, if I was interested in writing a book. And I thought, well, what would I want to write about? You know, what I had were sort of a few monologues and pieces that I had intended to perform and do in a sort of another sort of one-man show format that I had written. And I thought, well, I could take these and kind of turn them into like essays and see if I can sort of write a book of essays. That led me on a 2.5 year journey of writing what became this book, No Land's Man, which ended up being like the other writing that I have done, which is about identity and about immigrant identity, dislocation, race, you know, things that don't sound very funny, but can be, I try to take a humorous approach to those things.
Just on that subject of identity, and as I said in the introduction, a complicated backstory, is it something that you needed to work through or wanted to work through, or you wanted to write about it because so many people seem fascinated by it?
I didn't know if people were fascinated by it. I never know that. You know, I wrote it because it is probably something that I needed to work through. And you know, a lot of times writers write things, I think, cathartically to expunge things, get them out, you know, sort of deal with it in a way. The challenge is sometimes to take those things and also make them entertaining to readers. But yeah, I mean, these, you know, the stories that I wrote in the book are, I tried to take my personal experience, and they're all based in truth, and then try to tell a story around those things that had a larger resonance beyond just my own personal experience. So, you know, that's what I ended up sort of attempting to do in the book.
So let us talk about the background. So you're born in Bombay. At what point do you move to England?
Well, I didn't choose to move to England. My parents, I was a year old. So my parents, well, you know, I was like, a year old. I was like, I'm out of here. I'm done with this place. No, they decided to move to the north of England when I was a year old. I followed them and basically was raised as a little English kid. And then, or at least an Indian kid living in England, you know. Then my parents moved again when I was in high school. Or I'm 16 years old, my parents decided to emigrate a second time to the United States, and they came to Florida. The cultural sort of, the fact of going from the north of England to Tampa, Florida was a little bit head spinning, you know?
to say the least. And you're also, I mean, it's a very difficult time in our lives as humans, mm-hmm. being a teenager, and then to mm-hmm. have that kind of culture shock must have really added to it.
Well, it did. I mean, I was, before I left England, I was in an all-boys private school,
right?
Which was not, in, you know, it was a private British all-boys boarding school, not the greatest place for self-actualization or discovering, you know, one's own gifts or whatever. It was a pretty oppressive, tended to be, you know, there was a lot of, especially as a brown kid in that world, you know, dealing with the racism and the sort of bullying and hazing and stuff that went on in that school. And then I sort of, from there, taken to Tampa, Florida, where I was thrown into the middle of this American high school. And, you know, and I say in the book that growing up as an immigrant kid in England, like in England, you, as an Indian South Asian, you never felt like you were ever going to be British. Like the British have defended their island from invasion for thousands of years. And I think on some level, they're mistrusting of foreigners. And so you're never going to be truly British. And then it came to America, and it's the opposite is true. You know, the opposite, the immigrant experience in America is that it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what thousands of years of history and culture you may bring. You are now an American. And so forget all that. And, you know, there's a kind of openness, but also a lack of curiosity about any other countries other than America. And so in America, I sort of became invisible. You know, in England, I kept getting beat up for being brown. And in America, people just kept asking me, like, what are you? You know, so that's what I was sort of dealing with.
Did you come up with a good answer as to what are you?
You know, it was funny. At that time, you know, my high school in Tampa, Florida, you were either black or you were white, you know.
Right.
And it was the 80s, and the biggest star in the world at that time was Michael Jackson. And I realized that I could impersonate Michael Jackson. I could dance like him, and I could do all this stuff. So in becoming a Michael Jackson impersonator in high school, I actually found a weird answer to that question, you know, and sort of also played with my own racial identity in the way that Michael Jackson was playing with his own racial identity in the culture at large. Because if you remember, there was a period where Michael sort of looked a little bit like an Indian girl.
Yeah.
And before he went completely, you know, Caucasian. So it was a weird thing. I sort of found acting, and I found performing, and I found being a Michael Jackson impersonator as my answer to the question of who are you, you know?
You have a great, in telling that story in the book, which is a hilarious story, but then your grandparents come for a visit trying to figure out, I believe you refer just was kind of staring at your Indo-fro, wondering what had become of you.
Yes. Well, they were completely horrified, you know? I mean, they're clearly my parents had moved across the world, and they came to visit their grandchildren, and here I was, and I was walking around with a glove and sunglasses, and my hair was jerry curled, and they didn't know what to make of it, you know. But you know, it was great. Was I sort of performed for them, and I sort of tried to like do my little Michael Jackson thing, and my grandmother became incredibly enthralled with this idea that I was. She had no idea who Michael Jackson was, and then sort of learned through me impersonating him who he was. And then I have a line in the book where, for then weeks after that, after my little impersonation of Michael Jackson for her, she would walk into my bedroom and just say, "Billy John is not my lawyer," because that's how she heard it in her mind.
Well, the other thing I thought was interesting is, well, you look at your sister, for example, a different experience, right? I mean, it wasn't universal what you were going through, and I guess that's just sort of the difference in age, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was much younger when she came to the States, so you know, she was like 11 or something, and so for her, she had her own journey, but I think she assimilated in a way at 11 years old. Like, she had lost her accent immediately, her British accent, you know, and sort of started talking like an American. And I remember, like, when I got here, it was because just that 5 years created a difference for me of, like, I was a little bit more already kind of had an identification with being a British kid. And I remember I got to high school in Tampa, and the first person I tried to befriend was this other Indian kid, because I figured, oh, well, you know, but he was clearly... he was on the baseball team. He was in the band. Like, he was really cool, you know? And so he didn't want anything to do with me. And I realized that, like, as soon as I hung out with him, I realized, like, oh, he's all American and I'm mostly British, you know? And the only reason that I think this is going to work is because our parents are from the same part of the world, you know? And so he saw me as an incredible social liability and kicked me to the curb very soon. And then I ended up sort of trying to discover a place, my group in high school, which is what's so important, you know, and I ended up with the actors and sort of this, you know, drama class. And that's where I sort of found my place of self-expression and a way to sort of fit in.
Asif Manvi is our guest. His new book is No Land's Man, and it's published by Chronicle. You talk about that acceptance from the actors. And yet, even though it seemed like that was the career goal, to be an actor, that your early life was, okay, I'm set forever to play the brown guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first got to New York and I was kind of auditioning and stuff, you know, it was mostly that. It was mostly these stereotypical sort of roles that, you know, I have a story in the book called Patanking, which is a term that my friend Sakina Jaffrey came up with back in the early 90s, which was the sound that is made of the Indian accent as it's heard to the Western ear. So it's sort of like patank, 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 patank. And so we would have this thing where whenever we would go to auditions, we would, you know, be like, hey, did they make you patank? You know, did you do the patank? And that's inevitably what would happen. You'd go into these auditions and you would have to like do the head wobble and the accent and the whole thing. And, you know, and for a long time, that was sort of the nature of what it was until I actually, well, it was one audition I went to. I remember it was for a snake charmer. And the guy said, you know, can you do the accent and do the thing? And then they said to me, like, by the way, do you actually know how to snake charm? And I was so desperate for the job that I said, well, I'm Indian, so it's probably in my DNA. You know, I could probably do it. And, you know, so I played right into that whole thing. And then eventually realized that I kind of wanted to play roles that were more nuanced, that were more culturally true, you know. And so I started writing characters, which ultimately became my one-man show, Sakina's Restaurant, that were sort of the kinds of roles that I never got to play. You know, my Caucasian counterparts got to play much more interesting sort of parts, and I ended up, you know, playing into these sort of stereotypes or cartoonish type Indian characters, which is all there was for a long time.
And you talk about in the book that when you were called in for The Daily Show, you had an expectation of probably, well, that's what they want.
And yeah, well, I kind of thought that's what it was going to be. You know, when I got the call for The Daily Show, and I was talking to my manager, and they said, hey, The Daily Show is looking for a Middle Eastern guy. And I thought, well, this is got to be the most elaborate Homeland Security sting operation in the history of the world. And, you know, not a very effective one. But then they said, you know, they want you to audition. They want you to come down. And I thought, well, this is going to be like one of these things where I go down and I, you know, put on a turban and sit on a carpet and pretend to fly, or put on a fake beard and yell death to America. And I'd done these kinds of things on Letterman. I'd done the voice of Saddam Hussein or Jimmy Kimmel, where I'd done like a tech support guy or whatever. And I thought, I'm not doing this, you know. So I said no. And then they called back and said, look, they're looking for a correspondent. And I went down there still expecting that they were going to have me like patank, you know. And then John was like, no, as you are, just do. And it was a remarkable sort of shift for me, because I suddenly was like, oh, they just want me as an actor and, you know, bringing what I bring to this this role of this sort of fake journalist correspondent guy. And I didn't know what I was doing. So I just impersonated Stephen Colbert and got the job and was on the show the very same night that I auditioned. And to be fair, they had written this character of a Middle East correspondent who actually lived in the Middle East, and then they realized they didn't have a Middle East correspondent. So that's what precipitated these auditions. And I got the job. I was on that night. And then John just kept calling me back to be on the show and inviting me to come in and do stuff. And it was an amazing thing for me, because I felt like I was actually getting to speak into the zeitgeist in a way that I had never imagined or thought that I would. And and that went on for a few months, and then John finally offered me a contract on the show. But it was, you know, I talk about it at length in the book, the whole process of sort of becoming and accepting that brown correspondent role on The Daily Show.
Because you kept on, that first year especially, you write in the book that you kept on thinking, convinced that you were the wrong guy for the job, and that at some point the obituary was going to read that you had played more doctors on TV than any other person, and you were fired by Jon Stewart.
Right. Yeah, no, I really thought, you know, for the first, because I came from a completely different, at least what I, you know, I thought I came from a completely different pedigree to these guys who were all like real comedy people, you know, and I still don't think of myself as primarily a comedian. Like, I think of myself as an actor, and I had sort of cut my teeth on Chekhov and Ibsen and done all this stuff, and I was kind of like Shakespeare, and, you know, I'd done theater, and I was that guy, right? And suddenly I'm on The Daily Show, and I'm thinking, this is not going to end well. This is going to, they're going to figure out that I'm not right for this job. But, you know, basically what I did was I have always approached the Daily Show work in the same way that I've done any all the other acting work, which is that this is a guy who is a character that I play who happens to have my name. But he essentially is a character. He's much smarter than me. He has a whole team of incredibly smart, Ivy League educated Jewish comedy writers that walk around with him. And, you know, so that was what it was. And I just kind of played into that character and have continued to do so. So for me, it's, you know, people often come up to me and think that I am that guy on The Daily Show, or at least I'm as smart as that guy on The Daily Show.
And I guess the same could be said about Colbert, but with that character comes a confidence, right? A smugness.
Yes. I mean, that is the thing, you know, that I'm much more comfortable being that character or any character than I am probably being myself, you know, and what is that self? And, you know, maybe I'm a no lands man, you know, but there's a confidence that comes, and there's an ability to say things in a way that you couldn't otherwise. You know, when I used to do street improvisational theater down at Disney in Orlando, which was my first job out of college, I played this character who was a, you know, I'd never lived in New York. I'd never really spent much time in New York. But for some reason, there was this Brooklyn cab driver inside of me that I played at this Disney MGM Studios and in this street improvisational comedy troupe. And I remember just like allowing myself to be that character and approach strangers up on the boulevard there gave me an incredible sense of confidence. And I did things that I myself would never do in the guise of this character.
One of my favorite stories in the book is you're working with Ishmael Merchant, which yeah. I assume you could think would have gone better than it did.
Right, you would assume, right? Ishmael was a remarkable character, and he was a remarkable character study. You know, a larger-than-life sort of Barnum and Bailey guy. And he was, you know, in some ways, he was the epitome of the immigrant story. You know, he was right. This guy who had come from India and became one of the leading producers in Hollywood and got Academy Awards and BAFTAs and Golden Globes. But he was also this kind of Barnum and Bailey-type crazy person who gave me this incredible opportunity to star in this movie called The Mystic Masseur. And he came and saw me in the play Sakina's Restaurant that I did. And I remember, I tell the story in the book about how he invited me out to dinner to a restaurant that he claimed that he owned, but then none of the waiters actually seemed to recognize who he was. And so we sat there in this restaurant. He gave me the book, The Mystic Masseur, and said, read this book, you're going to be the star of this film. And I thought, well, this is it. You know, this is my big break. And then after that dinner, I didn't hear from the guy for a year. And so he just disappeared. And I thought, well, that was really strange. I must have met some weird Ishmael Merchant impersonator who took me to dinner, you know. And then a year later, he called me and his assistant called and said, you know, Ishmael wants you to go to a costume fitting. And I was like, I'm not going to a customer. I don't even know. The man hasn't talked to me. And he got on the phone and he was like, Asif, I'm very excited about this film. It's going to be tremendous. And he was just barreling forward with this film and completely ignoring the fact that we hadn't spoken for an entire year. And then got me the script and then didn't talk to me again for 6 months. And then we ended up in Trinidad making this film. And it was insanity. It was like, it was sort of me getting thrown into the world of independent filmmaking and him sort of being this artist who was kind of crazy but also sometimes genius, and you know, me being kind of also like, he was kind of like a crazy uncle to me in some ways. He gave me this huge break, but then the break turned out it was really the movie which I thought I was starring in was really a movie about him, you know. And so it's an interesting story about just my first experience of the story is called Movie Star, and it's really just my thoughts of what I thought being a movie star was compared to what it is when you're working with someone like Ishmael Merchant.
Do you feel as though you have a land now, a physical place and even a career place?
You know, it's an interesting question. I talk about it. I address it in the book a little bit. And you know, what I've realized, I think, over the course of time and in my professional career is that, like, I feel like my outsiderness and my that no lands man-ness is actually my source of power. and always feels like it is the creative place that I can go to and draw from at all times. So I don't ever think I'll feel like I belong to a particular place. But I think that that is now my creative sort of source, you know?
Well, the name of the book is No Lands Man. It is published by Chronicle Books. Asif Manvi, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for
taking
the time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. You very much. Again, the title of the book is No Lands Man by Asif Manvi. It is published by Chronicle. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.